everybody, and welcome to the Global Exhibitions Conference. That's a bit better. I'm Caitlin Page. I'm curator of public programmes here at Tate Liverpool, and I'm delighted to welcome so many of you to this day, which runs in conjunction with the exhibition Afro-Modern Journeys Through the Black Atlantic, which has been curated by Tanya Barson and Peter Gershotter, and is here at Tate Liverpool until the 25th of April. You all have copies of the full programme on your seats, so I'm not going to run through this exhaustively, but just briefly introduce the day and the format of the sessions. So we've worked with a number of partners in Liverpool, across Tate, and at the University of Arts in London to make this conference happen, and I just want to outline that briefly to give a context to the day. So the conference forms part of our Critical Forum series of conferences and related publications in partnership with Liverpool University Press. And Paul Goodwin, who's curator of cross-cultural programmes at Tate Britain, will act as overall chair for the day's discussions and devised and designed the focus of and structure of the day. And we worked together to produce the programme with TRAIN, the Research Centre for Transnational Art, Identity and Nation at the University of Arts in London. And later you'll see a panel led and put together by Michael Asprey, who's reader in art history at TRAIN. So the conference is called Global Exhibitions, Contemporary Art and the African Diaspora, and explores developments in the globalisation of the contemporary art of Africa and its many diasporas from a broad range of perspectives and case studies of particular exhibitions. And the aim of the day is to unravel or to at least explore some of the complexities of presenting and exploring the art of the African diaspora and situating it within debates around modernism. We're delighted to welcome so many distinguished speakers, many of whom have travelled very far to contribute to the day, which is largely based around short papers and followed by panel discussion, which is your opportunity to ask any questions. Just a couple of practical notes before I hand over to Paul. Please firstly ensure that your mobile phones are switched off. Just to note that the event is being recorded but not filmed. Microphones in the room will pick up audience questions and panel discussion. And lunch and refreshments will be served just outside this room on the concourse where you've just been. It's now my great pleasure to hand over to Paul Goodwin, who will introduce the first session.
Good morning, and thanks, Caitlin, for that introduction. And also thanks for the hard work that you've put into with the Liverpool team to really hosting this conference and setting it up. And it's great to see that there's a real kind of international interest in this conference. People have apparently come from far and wide, which I think is testimony to the excellence of the exhibition itself, but also, I think, to the increasing awareness and interest in the practice of artists from Africa and the diaspora. I think I'll just quickly give, because as you can see from the programme, we've got a fairly dense set of discussions, which I hope will be fruitful and will spark debate and conversation. But as you can see, we've got quite a lot of speakers and we've got little time. So I'm going to try to be fairly strict. We will try to be fairly strict on sort of policing time. So as a warning to our speakers, if you see me doing this, you know, you'll know that it's time to kind of write around. And just to say as well, I mean, it's just great. I think we're in Liverpool. I mean, obviously there are the historic kind of associations in Liverpool and the Black Atlantic, which I think make this a particularly kind of poignant and symbolic place to hold a conference like this and an exhibition like this. But for me, one of the great things, I mean, coming up to Liverpool recently, one of the things that has entranced me the most actually is the Scouse accent or dialect. And I just think it's something that, you know, I think when you do conferences, Caitlin, in the future, I think you should get every speaker to speak in Scouse, you know. I mean, Afro-modernism in Scouse, can you imagine the, anyway. I was practicing it to try and kind of give an opening, but I just thought, no, I won't go there. basically, that's my ambit of kind of getting you to wake up a bit this morning. So basically, in terms of structure of day, I mean, Afro-Modern Journeys Through the Black Atlantic is the latest in a number of huge international exhibitions that are focused on African and African diasporic art practice. And I think I'd just quickly run through a few examples from the last 10 or 15 years of that. So, for example, there have been exhibitions such as The Short Century, Independence and Liberation Movements in Africa from 1945 to 1994, which was curated by Okwie Nweso and travelled from Munich to Berlin, Chicago to New York. It was in 2001-2002. There was the three artists, three projects at the Dakar Biennial in 2004, curated by Salah Hassan and Cheryl Finley, and Cheryl is with us today. There was the Black Atlantic exhibition curated by Shaheen, who's be doing a keynote speech in Berlin at the House of World Cultures in 2005. There were, going through the list, Back to Black, Art, Cinema, and the Erasure of Imaginary was a big exhibition at the Whitechapel Gallery in London in 2005, which was curated by Richard Powell, David A. Bailey, and Patrine Archer-Straw. Of course, I'm sure many of you have seen, or did see, Africa Remix, which, again, a travelling exhibition from Düsseldorf to London to Paris, Tokyo, and Johannesburg between 2004 and 2007, chief curated by Suman and Jamie, with a number of collaborators, including Roger Malbert, who's here today, and will be giving a presentation on that. There's, of course, I'm sure many of you also remember, with perhaps mixed feelings, the Africa Pavilion at the Venice Biennial in 2007, quite controversial, curated by Fernando Alvim and again Simone Injami. And then more recently, I mean, there are a number, I'm sure I've missed out quite a few here. There's also Looking Both Ways, Art of the Contemporary African Diaspora in 2007, which is curated by Lauriane Farrell. And the list goes on and on. And I think what these exhibitions kind of point to is their global nature and the fact that they have kind of seen the work of African and African diasporic artists come to the forefront, the center of the international art world as never before. I mean, the issue of visibility has been an issue, I think, that many of us have been kind of struggling with, thinking about, curating against when it comes to the practice of African and African diasporic art. But now it seems that visibility is African and African diasporic art has achieved a level of visibility, globally, that perhaps marks, I would venture hesitantly to say, a kind of a new departure. And I think it means that it also raises a number of questions, a number of problematics, a number of clarifications that I think we could discuss today at this conference. Questions about, for example, the relationship between understandings of contemporary African art, okay, which is a particular kind of discourse, African diasporic art, okay, notions of the Black Atlantic, even notions of black or post-black art, in some ways have become kind of conflated, and these kinds of terms are circulating within this morass of the international exhibitionary complex. I think it would be really useful to try to think about and try to tease out what they mean and how they overlap and how they differ. Also, questions about the relationship of African and African diaspora artists to the exhibitionary complex itself. What does this mean for the ways that we might curate or present this kind of work? How are they situated in relation to questions of art history, methodology, to questions of modernism, postmodernism, and altermodernism, and all the other isms that are proliferating around the art world at the present moment, and of course for curatorial practice? So today we've got three panels that will effectively attempt to address, I'm sure not answer, but at least to try to kind of start to tease out some of these issues. We've got a panel, which I'm going to introduce very quickly in a minute, on this notion of diaspora. And for me, I've been thinking about, as many of you have been thinking about this idea of diaspora for many years, and the kind of proliferating notions of diaspora, different diasporas, new diasporas that are kind of being emerging out of this this exhibitionary kind of complex. We'll also be a panel looking at case studies of exhibitions and thinking about, again, what are the lessons that we can learn? What are the new curatorial narratives, or perhaps old curatorial narratives that need to be challenged, that come out of these exhibitions? And then we'll have a third panel, which will be looking at some of these issues around the diaspora within a specific context of the Americas. In between, we'll have a keynote lecture from Shaheen Morali, and also a really, I think, fascinating discussion which kind of puts these issues in a local context of Liverpool, with between Brian Biggs in discussion with artists featured in the Afro, two of the artists, sorry, featured in the Afro Modern Exhibition, Sonia Boyce and Keith Piper, who will be revisiting the seminal Black Skin Blue Coat exhibition in 1985. So we've got quite a lot to get through today. So quickly, I'll move on to our first panel, which is this notion of rethinking diaspora. And some of the kind of questions I think, and the relevance to art practice within the African and African diasporic context. And I think some of the questions that you've got in your packs there in front of you, I'll just quickly, briefly go through them. Might want to think about, you know, what are the uses? What ways has diaspora been deployed and used or misused within these exhibitions? And what are the tensions and conflicts, the overlaps, the perhaps potential misunderstandings between terms such as contemporary African art, okay, African diasporic art, and even black art? Do these terms still hold purchase? Is there such a thing as black art? We're talking about post-black art, but I mean, what does black art mean? And also the emergence, I think, one of the most important things or interesting things for me has been the emergence of new diasporas of migrant, well, not necessarily new, but kind of more a new focus around migrant African artists, so-called Afropolitans, that are kind of transforming the perceived geography and historical makeup of this idea of the diaspora, which was kind of formerly focused on a racial definition. So there are other questions I think we could address, but to address that first panel, we've got three fantastic speakers, all of whom I know personally well and have worked with at various stages, and really I think we're in for a really great start. We've got Dr. Raimi Badamoshi, who is an artist, writer, curator, has a doctorate from Slade School of Fine Art in London, and is a member of various research groups, such as the Afro-European Research Group at the University of Lyon in Spain, and the Black Body Group at Goldsmiths. He's also a member of the editorial board of Third Text. Following Raimi will be Carol Tulloch, who is a reader at Chelsea College of Art and Design at the Transnational Art, Identity and Nation Research Centre Train. She's also a fellow in the V&A, at V&A Museum, and was the principal researcher on the international project Dress in the African Diaspora Network. Carol was also curated a seminar exhibition in London, Black British Style, at the V&A, and is published widely. We've also on the panel got Dr. David DeBosa, who trained initially as a curator in Cambridge, studied in Cambridge, got a PhD in art history from Goldsmiths College, and then was a lecturer in fine art theory at Wimbledon College of Art between 2004-2008. He's currently the acting director of the Engine Room, an applied research unit, and David has published widely around some of the issues that we're going to discuss today. So we've got a fantastic lineup to start off with. I'd like to quickly then move over to Raimi and ask him to present his first paper, which is called Dancing in a Space Provided or Running Amok.
Okay. Good morning. So you just imagine that this is some kind of odd relationship. What you see and what you hear bear some relationship, and it's me. But outside of that, you know, it's wishful thinking, really. Okay. Dancing in a Space Provided or Running Amok. I'm going to read clearly, as you can see. Not So Bizarre Fantasies. Last week was a busy time for me, but I did manage to watch Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, yet again. Strangelove is that film that everyone has seen or is supposed to have seen and remembers for the emergent lunacy of Dr. Strangelove. The self-automating arm raised in salute, the sudden ability to walk in the face of the fruition of his eugenic fantasy, all become the hallmarks of a man devoted to the defense of the people he deems his own. Dr. Strangelove, while proposing 10 women to each man in the bunkered safety of a deep mineshaft, lets it be known that a computer will decide who goes underground and who faces nuclear annihilation. The sexual obsessions of the film, Dr. Strangelove, are now rather obvious. Names and places are filled with pent-up energy. The simultaneous release of the filmic tension and nuclear warhead with a hand-painted friendly, "Hi there," over enemy territory, while hilarious, illuminates the blind insanity that devotion to the nation state produces. So "Hi there" is the entry point to where my debates on the diaspora emerge. The twin warhead in the B-52's bay was dubbed with its own greeting of "Dear John." It is the "Dear John" moment that discussions on the diaspora consequently produce. We have had "Hi there." That was when the pickings were good and the joint disasters that were trading humanity and colonialism were looming. Now the mess has played itself out. The love affair is over. It feels like issues of the diaspora are always bound between the excitement of meeting and the potential of departure. However, whoever is deemed diasporic does not have the pleasure of knowing where they are in the relationship they find themselves in. The linking of destination produces the signification of power. Perhaps it is time to write that letter. So this is the letter. "Dear John, this has been a long time coming, but the dubious arrangement some observers supposed was love based on your self-deluding rose-tinted account has reached its end. To deliberately play on modern cliches, you had me at hello. But now the time has passed and I've got to know you better. I guess this relationship is not going to work. It has always and remains a one-sided transaction. You take all you want from me while you simultaneously denigrate all that is mine. I have been forced to move time and time again, initially because you dragged me kicking and screaming away from my home. And when that caused you too much embarrassment, you moved in, simply took over. The kids are fine though. This has always been a case for surprise and joy for me. They have a real sense of themselves. Guess they have the hindsight we simply could not have had. Now that you have the house and I'm on the road, that I have anything at all seems to cause you pain, well, it's over and I'm off. Signed, me." Alternatives to diaspora. At what point does an artist stop being in a diaspora and they can be at home where they find themselves? At what point do they start being in a diaspora and not simply away from home? Are arguments of the diaspora always going to be based on origins, on the trajectory of the ascendants? This is the query. Why can the individual artist not choose between the status of traveler or dispersed? And within this paradigm, it becomes arguable that artists can choose special status for themselves, as travel and displacement has become one of the hallmarks of this new avant-garde. While this is nothing new, Western modernism held the ability of artists to travel as well. The term diaspora does not figure too loudly. National and continental influences were acknowledged, but they were allowed, the artist that is, their individuality. And I'll just go on to another image. What is being implicitly asked of the artist is that artists attempt to singly address the questions of their own dispersion, even when they feel grounded where they are. All nations are imagined after all. They imagine communities. Perhaps it is time to accept a consistent lack of place. Questions. What is the difference between the diaspora and the expat community? How come we do not use the term European diaspora in the same way that we use, say, African diaspora? Settlers, colonizers, even adventurers maybe, but not diaspora. Is this because political domination demands a historical claim to land and links to the land? It is impossible to now discuss questions of the diaspora outside the larger problems of geopolitical inequalities. The dispersed is never the powerful. And when the dispersed do take over land to claim a home for themselves, the United States is a good, non-contentious example. Others abound. The language of the dispersal has a way of shifting. The implication is that for the diaspora, it is always seen, or rather the person in the diaspora is always in a subject position, and it is within this position of subjection that the artist enters into. And, well, some people, okay. Transnationalism. Transnationalism is now being treated and lauded as an alternative to the diaspora. Alongside multinationals, individuals are encouraged to see the world as a vast playing field to be conquered. However, national boundaries are to be respected within this new paradigm, as it is cheaper to extract resources while some other body foots the bill of policing, educating, and managing the people who inhabit the land. The art annual and biennale structures rely on a similar understanding of the world. The transnational artist is one not burdened with attachments to national boundaries, able to exploit every opportunity under the guise of personal and creative universality. But it is very clear that the world is still a playground for the few. The same logic that makes sure the Secretary General of the United Nations comes from a third world nation came up with the term global village. The possibilities presented are limitless. The essence remains the same. Okay, I'm going to wrap up because something is coming your way. Memory, and so I'll give you a few accounts. Walking along Upper Street on that Thursday in June when England beat Switzerland by 3-1 in the European Cup, I said out loud to my companion that football did not matter. A man, a complete stranger, beside us slowed down to pointedly state that football did matter. On my protestations that football simply did not matter to me in particular, he replied that a liberal Guardian reader would not understand that what this was all about. That at the time when nothing was going well for the English, it was important to celebrate every victory attained. I replied that I too was proud of British achievements. He retorted that this was about England and the Cross of St. George. He was becoming worked up, so I asked if he liked Wynton Marsalis. He retorted with Marsalis was American and football was English. He veered off to the left and we parted company, with me wishing that I'd asked him of Courtney Pine. And so I will read the end section. Okay, moments of personal crisis. I read a recent newspaper report of a man who had been stabbed to death, and his death had made him human in the eyes of the people. The headline read, Life and Death of an Illegal Immigrant. The same man, Sukhvinder Singh, until then was unwelcome by the state and the media. I really must move these things along, I'm going to forget. Until then, he was unwelcomed by the state and media, as I said. Then all of a sudden, he became something, something alive, to be rarefied because he had laid down his life for one of the very people who treated him as disagreeable. Now, I can imagine what the response would have been if he had been arrested and convicted of a crime against the state, property, or another person. What a feast the papers would have made of that. Sukhvinder Singh had lived incognito in London for 10 years, working away, being a model diasporan. And this is quite recent. He couldn't even go back to India when his son was killed because he couldn't leave the country, this idea of travel. His invisibility and humanity are defined by the state and the status quo. He is not allowed to reach any kind of actualization without the sanction of the state, which ultimately sees itself as a benevolent and fair partner in the activities in defining this man. Another recent incident causes me pause. 2 weeks ago, a young man had the words Paki and terrorist shouted into his face at the East London tube station at Plaistow by a young woman who one feels ought to feel different, even if she didn't know better. I tapped him on the shoulder after the abuse and told him not to worry about the insult, that she was probably unbalanced. He smiled at me and agreed. But now I realize my intervention was slightly complicated. She may or may not have been unbalanced, but it still remains that I took on the role of the indigent to pacify a man who also may or may not be as British as I am. The presence of the diaspora has made it impossible for the home to retain the promise of homogeneous security. The home has become unsure of itself. This lack of assurance is used to enhance arguments of the nation and its boundaries. The debate and struggles are being made around who is allowed entry into the homeland. The diaspora is therefore now linked with confusion at home and retention of otherness further afield. There is a price, however, for inclusion in debates of the diaspora. It involves retaining an identifiable difference for the person who needs to see the other in the diaspora, Of course there are benefits. There always are. I'll now end. Well, kind of end, anyway. By playing you a piece of music. But before I do that, something's going to be distributed to you, and you have to make a very, very quick decision. How much time have I got left?
Oh,
great. Ha. Okay. So you have to make a very, very quick decision, and you can only choose one, and they're going to be handed out to you. So you're going to listen to some music, and then I'll probably talk over that, and then something else happen. So, okay, let's go. Where's the volume?
Every one of us had to come home again. We all, every one of us.
Sorry, I should go a bit slower, really. So I'm trying to get somewhere.
That we never return to the bottom. Where you know we all, every one of us, had to come home again.
I will get, okay, so I'm trying to get to. Pleasing itself now. Play. Okay, are we there yet? Oh, come on, you know. Yeah, time. It's not quite money. Well, it is actually, but. So those who have the cards, you need to take your biro out or pen, and some of you already have the cards, so those who do not. I want you to turn the card over, and on the top line, I would like you to choose three letters at random, that are your choice, and write those. And the line below, six digits of your choice, go on the line below. So if you just do that as well now. And those we are waiting until you. Instructions again. The top line. I would like you to write three letters of your choosing. You choose what you want them to be. And the line below, six digits of your choosing. So you choose. Okay? Is okay, I'll just, one last time, I'll read out the, tell you what I'd like you to do. On the top line, you should write three letters of your choosing. And on the line below, six digits of your choosing. And I assume everyone's got one. Has everyone received one? Okay, great. Everyone?
Yes.
Now, I would like you to, and you've done your writing. Great. Now I'd like to find each other. So get up. And find each other. Yeah? You have cards. find each other. So one lot over there, one lot over there, and one lot over here. Go on, find each other. Your identity card of the Republic, you keep them. They're now yours.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. I must admit, I was getting very nervous about presenting today because I'm kind of the only person that's kind of looking at dress, but I will mention a few artworks, but Raimi, thank you, because that was brilliant, because that's just relaxed me completely and helped set the scene for some things I'm hopefully get across today. Okay, so like Raimi, I'm going to read mine. Okay, brilliant. Since 2005, I've been connected with a series of group projects that have essentially been an exploration on dress associated with the African diaspora, and tried to push critical thinking on the terms diaspora and African diaspora and the dynamics of these concepts in terms of dress. So the presentation is going to be a brief outline of these projects. I've looked at a couple of them. I decided to pop this slide in. Which, as I say, this article is called Interconnecting Roots, and really focused on what it means to work within a network and the kind of work that one does in the network to talk about these issues. But I use the term dress here as it acts as an umbrella term which incorporates the range of components that contribute to the clothed body: fashion, styling, garments, textiles, accessories, body art, hair culture, and the production and consumption of and use of these. And of course, these can be extended to include items connected with various components of dress that have informed artworks, as in here, Susan Stockwell's piece, Pattern of the World, Where You Can Lengthen or Shorten Africa. I want to also talk about, as I say, projects, group projects. And here, these are networks or workshops that people came together, for example, academics, designer makers, artists, curators, design consultants, professionals, stylists, photographers, black or white, to use sort of binary terms, that came from and or worked on different parts of Africa, Europe, the Caribbean, South and North America, that has impacted on our understanding of how dress can operate within the African diaspora and what diaspora and African diaspora can be and mean. Running out of space. The International Dress and, I was principal investigator of the International Dress and the African Diaspora Network, which operated from January 2006 to December 2007. The idea for the network was inspired by the fact that dress has proved to be an authoritative method of examination into the issues of place and space, history and culture of black people. And additionally, the historical and cultural ruptures that resulted in the creation of the African diaspora. Have impacted on those who moved from their homeland and to other parts of the world, so-called motherland, or whilst individuals who remained in their, in Africa and the Caribbean, experienced enormous changes in their relationships between groups within the diaspora. Therefore, these issues have had an impact on the way different kinds of people within the African diaspora have negotiated and defined their sense of self, despite the legacy of inequality meted out through the ruling fiction of race, ethnicity, and class. And those of us who have engaged with dress in this wide catalogue of uses to discuss this, this network is an ideal basis to tease out a range of issues from local or regional concerns to the connections between different cultural geographies. This was undertaken in a series of workshops in London and Davis, University of California, Davis, and open panel discussions at the V&A and an international symposium, reading group, and publications. The gang were an international team of eight that were featured here, and they devised a critical framework that became the basis for the directional thinking of DAN, which they consolidated in these points here, to the notion of the between, the tension and flows of ideas, historical and cultural activities that have had an impact upon African diasporic dress, textiles and beauty regimes, and its associated wearers, producers and observers, and was the theme of the two-day international symposium, Dress in the African Diaspora, Tensions and Flows, which was held at the V&A in 2007. And these were the themes that formulated the ideas for papers. The symposium represented a range of research interests and methodologies which covered different parts of the diaspora, Kuala Zulu-Natal, Dakar, St. Louis, the Senegal, and Bamako, Republic of Niger, Antwerp, Paris, Germany, Switzerland, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Britain, the United States, Jamaica, Trinidad, and Bahia, with a time period which spanned from slavery to the 21st century. Sorry, which I've just listed. Oh, and there's just a few examples of the papers that were people that represented this. The event demonstrated what session chair John Picton saw as a need for more detailed histories of the differing diasporic forms to counteract the old histories and their homogeneity. The symposium was also confirmed the critical possibilities of dress in the African diaspora. For example, speakers questioned the role of national museums in the collection and preservation of objects associated with the subject, and how to address museums that, according to symposium contributor Nicola Stigliano, acts as a block rather than a conduit for the flow of diasporic articles. In line with this, the project discussed the rarity and fragility of the archive in this field of study and the way it constructs interesting models of identity. DAN generated fresh ideas and new routes of investigation, for example, the relevance of the inter- and multidisciplinary aspects of the subject that has engendered a recovery of agency to advance critical and empirical approaches to the study of dress associated with the African diaspora. whilst the network threw into question issues such as traditions, modernity and authenticity, an area of particular concern with regards to dress practice across Africa. For example, the coexistence of different forms of modernities in South Africa alongside traditional dress, which Professor Nettleton referenced as Afropolitanism. Whilst Janice Cheddy argued in this debate that black artists should have the right to be inauthentic, and this was her reaction to the way museums include black artists as the authentic voice of the diaspora. Participants reconsidered the notion of what diaspora means now. Professor Leslie Rabin introduced the concept of diasporic reversals, a kind of looping back, the way people move in and out from the center to the periphery and back again, a more reflexive understanding of diasporic movement. And the need to unpack terminologies such as Professor Susan Kaiser's exploration of knots in relation to the contemporary Black American fashion and sports, Black American fashion and sportswear, and the rules that have been extended in basketball, for example, towards Black players on court styles, and how that has been taken up by the public. Susan's critical thinking, detailed examinations, expressed how detailed examinations are fundamental to the negotiations of black identities and their cultural influence. Therefore, the introduction of new terminologies such as knots, black reversal, looping back, with regard to dress culture in the African diaspora, illustrated that the diaspora was not always about flows. These are a reminder, Christopher Breward stated, that the movement of people, objects, and ideas is not always so fluid or unimpeded. And to go, just continue a little bit about that terminology, one of the, which seemed to be a real kind of bugbear for us on the network, the term style became problematic. So for example, Van Dyke Lewis sees style as styling, doesn't like to use the word style in connection with black dress in the African diaspora. And he sees styling as just something that is done by professionals in a professional capacity. Whilst I'm prone to use the term style as agency in the construction of self through the assemblage of garments, accessories, and beauty regimes that may or may not be in fashion at the time of use. And whilst Lewis refers to professional fashion stylists, I see the styling practice of a lay person's articulation of everyday life through their style body as equally valid. For me, this is part of the processes of self-telling, that is to expand an aspect of autobiography of oneself through the clothes choices an individual makes, what I have come to call style narratives. Fundamentally, what the research undertaken within Dan came to that there is expressed that there is a complex network of traceable associations between networks of objects, people, and geographies associated with dress and the African diaspora. Another project was the Interaction Networking Event and Cultural Heritage held in Zambia in 2005, which was organized by British Council Zambia in partnership with the National Heritage Conservation Commission of Zambia. I'm running out of time. This event encouraged participants to challenge the deficit view of Africa by recognizing success and learning from what has worked and is working on the continent. To tackle such a vast subject, the delegation of education, culture, and political specialists that represented 18 countries across Africa and the United Kingdom were placed at the center of deliberating processes on the subject. And then there was a series of workshops, one of which was the Fashion and Textiles Workshop, which was placed up people led experiment around the issues raised in the networking debate, but do this through producing clothes, which were not supposed to be high fashion or high quality, but just kind of an experimental way of expressing that through clothing. So, for example, Zambian fashion designer Claire Chona used Zambian cultural references to reinforce personal and national identities. She designed a white A-line strapless floor-length dress she called Ubuntu, which derives from the Bembe language. Zambia means ethnic connectedness, unity of purpose, and who we are. Claire painted the freehand of her country onto the front of the dress of what she described as village life and art. L'Estoile Commune was a project that took place at the Kunstlerhaus, Stuttgart, in 2006. And here was a series of interconnected critical and designer maker curatorial sections that translated into textual and visual narratives, critical and empirical concerns, which addressed the complexities of the social through the black body, garments, accessories, and textiles. And so some of the discussions within the workshops were asking the questions, what effect does migration have on fashion and style? What are the meaning of historical events and their cultural and political changes for the development of fashion? What role does the interrelationship between styles of the diaspora and the home country play? The workshop wanted to address the possibilities of clothing to question how to present oneself to the world as a crucial communicative medium in the public and social space. So this aspect of the network was given a subsequent layer of meaning through an exhibition called Couture Commune. And within that, Zora Puco produced, who's an African-German fashion designer and maker, produced these works, which were informed by biographical statements from interviews Zora conducted with six men and women from different parts of the world, where all but one lived in Germany. Zora imprinted some of the garments with the statements. I'm trying to jump around. So the interviews engendered self-reflection for Zora in the production of the clothing, and using some of the statements on the clothing, which resulted in individualized responses to the questions, who, what, how am I? Zora translated her respondents' views on identity, included what she called branding the wearer with some of the statements. So for example, Zora printed a quote from the interviewee Steffi from Germany down the back of a sleeve of an orange padded jacket, which said, I feel at home because everything is like I thought it should be. By doing so, the garments created for identity became a plane for several voices, for that of the interviewees and Zora herself. She's present as designer, maker, and narrator. I'm going to jump forwards. Zora explained that it was her own life experience of being African-German, born and raised in Berlin, East Germany, and her utilization of handicraft tools, I quote, which enabled her to create a response to questions of identity, an answer she feels goes beyond what is wearable and bearable of others. A more recent project, Prêt-à-porter, was a series of transnational dialogues on fashion, Africa, its diaspora, and the myriad identities constructed from this. This was curated by Elke Osten-Moore, who's here today, and it took place in 2008, which 17 artists, theorists, and designers came together in Dakar from different parts of Africa and Europe to explore questions relating to fashion, sport, identity, history, and movement with a multimedia and interdisciplinary approach. As Elke outlines in the introduction to the catalogue, as the workshop title Prêt-à-porter makes clear, while the focus was upon fashion, it was not about prêt-à-porter, but design made ready-to-wear clothing, but about sharing experiences. The aim of the workshop was to provide an opportunity for an active process-orientated exchange amongst professionals in various creative fields whose lines of work would cross and become interwoven. In close conjunction with the location, a social fabric was created of individual stories and fantasies of relationships and practices. The visible result is a multi-layered exhibition of textual, photographic, sculptural, and installational elements. I'm just going to jump forwards. because I know I'm running out of time. Okay, whilst I was co-curating the exhibition A Right of Our Own about the Rock Against Racism movement of 1976 to 81, the inclusion of this 1976 photograph by Sid Shelton of a pupil in his Tulse Hill Comprehensive School blazer made a connection for me with the 1976 photograph of Sam by Sam Anzima, which was on display at the Hector Peterson Memorial Museum in Soweto. This photograph was taken during the Soweto uprising on the 16th of June 1976, when some 10 to 15,000 school students took the streets in response to their growing anger to the rule that from 1975 black African students should be educated in Afrikaans, the language of apartheid, which became what became known as the killer language. And as the unarmed students marched towards Orlando West and fired upon by the police, they kind of defended themselves using dustbins, and hence the photograph was displayed with local dustbins at the memorial and museums. So it was kind of a narrative on a moment of political activism. So therefore, the students were no longer acting like or being a good student. They were politically active pupils and individuals who employed subjectivity and agency to secure their selfhood and future as black South Africans, and thereby confronting the official gaze. Whilst the image of the Tulse Hill pupil and his regulation blazer was co-opted into anti-racist mediations produced by Rock Against Racism. For example, Sid Shelton, who was a Raw London committee member when he took the photograph in 76, reflects his documentary approach during this period. Shelton is also a graphic designer and used the image in 1970. Sorry, some more photographs on that period. From 1978, on the record sleeve and flyer for the single Up Against the Wall, sorry, the social critical single Up Against the Wall, which Shelton was commissioned to design by fellow Raw Committee member Tom Robinson for his band. One could argue that the school blazers were connected through different degrees of anti-racist activity and became, to Barani Coombe's term, the recalcitrant object, to signify kicking against constraint or restriction, to be obstinately disobedient or refractory. The question is, do these two examples of school uniform become black school uniform with a particular identity and history connected to specific moments in political activism and social history in the African diaspora? What can be said is that these two examples of a relationship between a black body and school uniform in London and Soweto in the 70s is that they illustrate the traceable associations of objects, people, geographies, activisms, and histories. That is a network of ideas and concerns that connect Africa and its diaspora. And I wanted to include this because a member of the Dressing the Africa Brand Diaspora Network felt we had to decide whether we were looking at Africa or the African diaspora, which for me did not include Africa. This point of sort of niggled me for some time. For me, it's always been Africa and its diaspora, and I'm sure it was the stance that subconsciously informed my connection between the London and Soweto teenagers and in their school uniform. George Shepperson's article in 1965 kind of comforted that notion of Africa and its diaspora in his paper, The African Abroad or the African Diaspora, which he argued the study of African diaspora is a study of Africa and the groups that formed outside of Africa following the Atlantic slave trade and imperialism. He saw this approach as an expansive understanding of Africa and its diaspora and the contributions to universal history. The legacies of the Atlantic slave trade and imperialism are the frames for the African diaspora and their impact on the development on the different groups of the diaspora. And for Shepperson, diaspora is a flexible term that can be considerably extended both in time and space, and part of the use of the concept is precisely in its extensions. That was his statement in 65. So just to pull out some of the points these projects have generated from address African diaspora and diaspora and what can be enabled. Then there's this, again, the notion of the between, that's kind of tensions and flows, block, looping back, continued search for identities, like, again, the traceable associations of objects, people, geographies, activisms and histories, expansive critical thinking, sharing experiences and communicative connectivity. That's it, thank you.
Okay, I guess that's kind of a natural break for people to, I think they still have fag breaks, don't they? People going out having cigarettes, etc., and that's absolutely fine. I'm going to just start, as I ever do, by giving some thanks, and for the first time I'm going to give an apology. But the thanks go to Paul Goodin for his kind invitation, also to the Tate Liverpool team, Mike Stout, Emma Ashman, who's here. Thank you very much for all your help for getting me here in one piece. And of course to Caitlin Page, without whom I actually wouldn't be here. Also thank you for the very warm introductions that were given. I think I was described as a distinguished speaker. And I found that strange. Nobody used to call me distinguished before. And I actually think it's something to do with the moustache. I'm going to shave it off and come back and maybe see whether people call me distinguished again. Anyway, those are the end of the thanks. And the apology is in two parts. The apology, first of all, is in terms of the presentation, in the sense that the way in which I'm going to look at some of the works isn't going to be quite as analytical as I would like. And I'm thanked to Carol and Rhymy for framing this event, because it allows me not to be as analytical as I might need be, and Carol particularly for your analysis of the works, the individual works that you were looking at across your paper. I'm not going to be analytical because I'm going to be political. And I'm going to be political because as a, I guess, a response to many of the discussions, debates that I've been involved in over the past months, perhaps even years, around these particular questions about Africa, its diasporas, Afropolitanism, etc., I've found that a lot of analysis has been done around these terms. And I'm beginning to find, for myself at least, that analysis is somehow not enough. That in some ways it gives us or leads us to some of what I call the problems of the intellect and intellectual life, which is that it can lead one so far. But at some point, one has to make a decision. At some point, one has to be political. And politics, I'm finding as I get older, is not actually an aspect necessarily of the intellect. That politics is an act of will. It is an act of will and an act of imagination. So thank you to Rhymy for bringing forward this whole and bringing live the question of the imagination and the imaginative component of the political. So for me, in terms of thinking about Africa and the relationships of Africa and its diasporas, it is about imagining, it is about what we want to imagine, who we want to imagine ourselves to be. And I was reminded this morning with a lovely conversation I had with Mark, also in relation to those who are to come. What do we want to help them imagine themselves to be? What do we want to be able to make possible for them to imagine? Okay, so that's my starting point. And I too am going to just read for the sake of time. I start my paper with a question. In an era characterized variously as one of globalization, deglobalization, and reglobalization, what roles do the practices of contemporary artists and intellectuals related to Africa play? I situate African-related art practice in terms of the global as a means of building on the foundations set by debates in the 1990s, particularly the works of Paul Gilroy, The Black Atlantic, but also the work that many of you will know, the work of Manuel de Landa, 10,000 Years of Non-Linear History. These works encouraged us to think about culture no longer in national terms, but first and foremost in terms of the circulation of people and resources across national boundaries. So over the past decade, the importance of the Atlantic as a motif for exploring such international circuits of exchange has given way to a broader emphasis addressing the Pacific-based relations between the Americas and East Asia, as well as the relations that China and India are forging between themselves and other parts of the world, including, of course, various African states. The shift in global geopolitics reflects, of course, change in capital flows, as well as shifts in international investment and newly emerging patterns of commodity exchange. So the focus of my paper, then, is to ask how far art practices, particularly those related to Africa, can help develop a critical relation to these newly emerging geopolitical situations. So criticism, geography and politics all together in this situation. So within that, why should art practice matter? Why should it matter in a situation that is governed largely by what one might say is political, economic forces? Well, for me, art practices matter because they are already enmeshed in international circuits of exchange, and in many respects, they reflect them. The deep involvement of contemporary visual art in such matters must be obvious in some terms, and it might barely be worth restating that art as a highly prized and highly priced commodity is situated amongst newly emerging commodity flows. So take, for example, the growing prominence of a range of international art centers outside Europe and North America. Art centers in South Asia, art centers in East Asia, art centers in Africa. Take, for example, Art Expo India, which has grown in importance as a major center for contemporary Indian art markets. Its organizers claim to have, in 2009, some 20,000 visitors. So such prestigious events, then, can also be linked to such moments such as the planning of the opening of the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi, which has been heralded by Frank Gehry's vision for the new institution, and the development of an area of prestige for collecting and display, an exhibitionary practice. We can talk in West Africa, as we have, about the Dakar Biennale, based in Dakar, Senegal, and the way it has been providing an international platform for contemporary African art for more than a decade. In Southern Africa, we can talk about the two Johannesburg Biennales, particularly the second Biennale in 1997, curated by Okwi Onwuzor. We can also talk about a whole range of changes which have taken place in relation to the Venice Biennale. You know, talk particularly in relation to the Chinese Pavilion in 2007, created by Hu Hanru, and the Africa Pavilion, to which Paul has already referred, created by Simon Njami and Fernando Alvim. So the movement of cultural practitioners, artists and intellectuals, following the movement of artworks and art practices across the five continents, demonstrates that art practice remains completely implicated in the range of geopolitical changes which are shaping our world. So now, having established that relevance of contemporary art practice and its implication in geopolitical conditions, one might question whether such art practice should be burdened with the responsibility of being critical. Why should artworks and, if you like, art exhibitions such as the Africa Pavilion, why should they be asked to frame a criticality suitable for our world, our ever-changing world? So, in a sense, one can ask why African, Asian art should be automatically implicated in arguments that emerged out of a bourgeois conception of late 19th century modernism, which insisted that art needed to be critical, that art needed to have a critical relationship. Does the avant-gardist notion of the artist as a site of the critique, a critique of bourgeois norms, which we see back to our historical moment, where this moment was framed with the work of, for instance, of Courbet's Bonjour, Monsieur Courbet, does this moment of criticality where we ask and force artists to act in this way which is critical, is this necessary? And is this a burden that we need to place on in terms of African-related art practices? Do we need a 21st century encounter or version of this moment? Could we imagine something like Hank Paulson greeting Yinka Shonabare on Fifth Avenue, saying, good day to you, Mr. Shonabare, or perhaps even more ridiculous, imagine Mervyn King meeting Chris Ofili on Threadneedle Street and saying, God bless you, Mr. Ofili. Yes, I think these things have to be imagined. These things have to come to mind. So, in a way, I think we need to put the genealogies of that criticality and that sense in which artists need to be critical, we need to put those in place. But having said that, we still also need to understand that there are disadvantages which face African states and also African workers, cultural and otherwise, within international systems of exchange. And that cannot be ignored. Many artists, such as Zeynep Zedira, whose work showed recently at Innova, remind us of the costs of the movement, the migration of African workers internationally, the huge costs of that movement, of that flow. We can think about the cost of the movement of workers. We can think also, as we are constantly reminded, about the disadvantages which are placed on the movement of African goods into international systems of exchange. And if we begin to think about the disparity between the movement of goods and workers, and the way, in fact, that sometimes African goods, particularly intellectual goods, such as artworks, books, the way that they are able to move more freely across borders than the people who made them themselves. And I'm sure I'm not alone in people amongst the audience here of people who've been to conferences such as these, where artists' works in exhibitions such as Afro-Modern, the works are here, the books are here, the ideas are here, but the artists couldn't get a visa. And these are major issues in relation to this question about how migration, the movement of objects, goods, services, and people across the globe has to be continually readdressed. So it's in relation to that question, then, that I think that we need to continue to emphasize the, if you like, political, or the political aspect of some of the work that we're doing. For the purposes of this discussion, I focus on the first African pavilion at the 52nd Venice Biennale held in 2007. And what I want to suggest is that that biennale traces the emergence of what I'm calling a critical relation to internationalized systems of exchange. I premise my arguments on the comments made by the pavilion's co-curator, Simon Njami, made during a discussion with the Biennale Artistic Director, Professor Robert Storr, in 2007, hosted there, as you see, by David A. Bailey. At the heart of the discussion was a tension between Storr's position around the role of African art within an international framework and that of Njami, which situated African art first and foremost in relation to Africa. Storr contended that the appearance of an African pavilion for the first time at the Venice Biennale was an important advance for the international art community. In contrast, Njami denied the relevance of the international art community, insisting that the value of the pavilion lay in its foregrounding of an African perspective from contemporary art and the debates that surround it. So it's an important difference. The value is not in terms of the international community and what the international community gets out of African art and its circulation. The value is in relation to Africa and African art and African intellectual capital, if you want to use that term. Okay, so it's about changing, if you like, the focus of the heart of the perspective. In Njami's assertion of an African critical position generated by artists, artworks, collecting, and exhibitionary practices, There was great note and points made about the articulation of a position that sets aside the claims made for the work, claims that issue from North America and European locations. So Europe and North America cease to be the central points or the most important points in terms of the critical framing of the meaning, relevance, and significance of African art practices. Njami refuses the critical privilege that allows European and North American thinkers to arrogate to themselves the right to delimit the terms under which African art is understood. Instead, the key is to elaborate the discourse that is emerging from Africa and to recognize that it acts as a discourse on the global, Africa looking at the global, not just Africa looking at the Africa. So first, set aside North America and Europe and the critical positions which define African art. See African artists, intellectuals, and their networks as the core in terms of understanding and framing African art, and then look to those critical positions to have a re-understanding, a reimagining of what the world might look like and what the world must mean in the years to come. An African discourse on the global is not exclusively a facet of the contemporary. I think this is an important point to make. The critique of imperial governance articulated in the liberation movements of Africa, North and South, presented an African discourse on the global. For instance, the negritude of Senghor and others offered a reconsideration of African values and what they could offer to the world. Indeed, such critiques worked at the heart of modernity, exposing the subjugation and exploitation that made modernity possible through the disequilibrium of industrial practices and trade arrangements. Basically, what I'm trying to say here is that Afro-modernity, as we are imagining it, and I'm foregrounded as a space of politics and imagination, Afro-modernity must work as an ambivalent term. It privileges the new modalities of being brought to fruition through a new valuing of African aesthetics. But at the same time, it produces a critique of the conditions, the critique of the conditions of modernity, which made those very practices possible. Okay? So in a sense, what I'm trying to say is that Afro-modernity must seek to, if you like, look to modernity and its values in terms of showing the ways in which African thinkers such as Senghor brought forward a different way of thinking about Africa. So in a sense, it's liberatory, if I can use that term. But at the same time, there's a critical element because that very modernity was premised on the exploitation of Africa and its resources. So, and we have to take both sides of that equation, okay? And that kind of ambivalence, I think, must inhabit the ways in which we start to think. Okay, and there are several artists I know who have worked around this issue. This is not a diptych, but I just wanted to show you the work of Samuel Fosso here because I think it helps us think through some of the points that I'm making. So for the purposes of this discussion, the value of Afro-modernity lies not so much in the ambivalence that inhabits its historical manifestations, okay? So I'm setting aside slightly the history, but thinking about the intellectual labor, the work that we're doing here, to frame it as a discursive tool. So it comes back to us. What does our current investment mean? To what purpose can we assign the present need to recollect the various trajectories of African marks and iconographs within modernist and postmodernist canons? So I'm asking, why are we here? Not just why are we here in this moment, but why are we here in relation to this exhibition? What is the intellectual work that we're doing here today? How is this exhibition positioned in a way of beginning to, if you like, rethink modernist and postmodernist canons? What is the value of that intellectual labor? So in some respects, one must look at the working practices of contemporary thinkers such as Okwi Emweso, Oluwagibi, Salah Hassan, as regards the formation of the discourse of African contemporary art. Equally, of course, we have to look at the art practitioners such as Sukari Douglas-Camp and Bodies Isek Kingeles, which continue to generate compelling works that can be approached under the rubric of what might be termed Afro-contemporary. So in such terms, Afro-modernity becomes a discourse made possible by the emergence of Afro-contemporary. Okay? And what I'm trying to do in this slightly sophisticated argument, is to try and bring us back to us and back to now. That what we can say is we can, if you like, begin to reimagine or recollect a particular kind of history and say that Afro-modernity represents a particular historical moment and a particular set of historical practices which are important. That has value. But what also has value is for us to ask ourselves why we're doing this. And the reasons why we're doing it and why we're doing it now are as important as the things that we say about what happened back then. Okay? And that's the work, I think, of history. So if we consider the work of making history, if we understand what we do when we try to make history, and we understand it as an iterative process, a process where we bring back things which have come from the past, then past events become acknowledged on the basis of traces recognized in the present. It is the present that is key, the present and what we're able to recognize from the past. In such terms, we must ask ourselves which traces are being recognized and which are being ignored. So what is being acknowledged is something that is resurging. We acknowledge what we see as resurging. We think through Afro-modernity in terms of traces of African-related gestures. A brushstroke or a carved mark becomes acknowledged as having inherent meaning and intrinsic value. It gets reiterated through a citation in non-African traditions such as surrealism and 20th century modernism. We have to ask ourselves, however, what we see as being inherently African, that is being reiterated. What is intrinsic? What is this intrinsic meaning in the mark, in mark making, or something that we collect? Okay, so let's think about the ways in which we might reaffirm these different elements that I've brought together. Critiques of modernity, African iconography. How can we bring these things together, thinking, intellect, politics, and also throw in a complication which was already in our day with Rimey's interventions, the importance of a complication, which of course occurs when we start to think about Africa in terms of a continent of Africa, which of course includes the African Maghreb, includes South Africa, includes a whole range of what were pointed to as not termed diasporic, but are in fact European diasporas. What happens when we include those? People like Derrida and Hélène Cissou. And I'm thinking what we do is we make use of that. We make use of that because with Derrida's work, we can reanimate a motif of what Derrida termed the Babel Tower, where we can move away from an idea of a unitary formulation of African aesthetic. So in a sense, going back to this idea that knowledge isn't necessarily built just as one unitary structure in order to, if you like, develop and enhance our power. Knowledge actually is also about fragments, about migrations, about that which is migratory. And again, I come back to the importance of the creative moment, the creative gestures in today's work that we're doing today, to remind us about, as Rimey's work did, the importance of that migration and the dispersal, and thinking about the ways in which people make choices about finding each other. And I did think the next move, which I'm glad, Rimey, you saved us from, which is the question of losing each other. Okay? So if you like, we need to think about, if you like, making use of the complexity, if you like, of this African diaspora and the diasporic formation as a way of giving us, if you like, a treasure trove of things which we can take at will and bring together and sometimes, if you like, to lose. Okay, so I want to just come and wind up now with my last point of my polemic. I was just talking there, wanted to just bring us there to state that a lot of these ideas, in a sense, I'm not saying anything that's original or new, and actually trying to, if you like, give a critical cast to a whole series of works that have been taking place, an activity that's been taking place for quite some time. And I point here, of course, to another seminal moment, the Documenta 11, which is curated by the chief curator, anyway, was Okuyan Wesel, but I know it was created by a number of people. And I only wanted to put that up to remind us that this work, this kind of work, is already being done. It's in the world by obviously some of the people in this room. But what I thought was important just to underline was the way in which exhibitionary practice as well has taken up this complexity and reflects this kind of complexity, as we had with the Documenta 11, which was generated in relation to five platforms. It had five different settings where this international exhibition took place. So again, a move away from this notion that knowledge has to be held in this one tower and we're all moving towards one thing, and to maintain this idea that dispersal is part of it. The migration of ideas is part of the work that we're doing. So I come back to now. The work starts here. And we look to Afro-modernity to establish antecedents, prior traces of dispersal and critical reflection. And alongside that, one might need to speak also of a futurity. Because to speak of Afro-modernity in relation to the contemporary is already to establish a notion of time, a diachronics, if you like, a thinking through of time. What we need to set out is an intellectual program, and an intellectual program that sees futurity as a political act. It remains part of the claim that we are making about the here and the now. What we have to start saying is that Afrofuturity, which isn't the same as Afrofuturism, I know that's different, Afrofuturity, thinking about the intensification of migrations which have already started, the proliferation of centres of power, north, south, east and west, across the five continents, we will see the transmission of African-related art practices across those five continents, and we begin to have to look at the way in which that engagement, how that engagement is going to take place and how we're going to think about it, how we're going to think about Africa in relation to not just North America, South America, as I know that many of our, we've been thinking along the lines, Africa in relation to Africa, but Africa in relation to Asia, East Asia, West Asia, Australasia, and beginning to think about this global setting, which in some senses some people will say, well, that's not here, we're not seeing those practices. But as I started, I think it has to be a question about imagining, and imagining the kinds of future that we want to build. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank Raimi, Carol, and David for, I think you'd agree, an incredible range of material that we can kind of use to as a point of discussion that are ranged across, you know, so many issues that I've, just some notes that I've taken down, the idea of diasporic imaginaries, notions of travelling, consistent lack of place, interconnections, networks, politics. We've got about sort of 10, 15 minutes for some questions. I just want to quickly, briefly, just jump in with some of the things that struck me about all three presentations, which were, so I'd like to thank you all for that, it was really fantastic. One thing really is, for me, is what stood out is this question of politics and the political nature of diaspora as a term in terms of how we use diaspora, how is diaspora deployed? And I thank Carol for mentioning George Shepperton, who was a kind of one of the founding writers on this issue. If you go back and look at some of his work, which comes out, he was really writing in the 1950s, at a time when questions around Pan-Africanism, Garveyism, etc., were being reassessed and assessed in relation to American post-war global concerns about the Cold War. So in a way, I think it will be really useful to kind of go back to that sense, because it does bring in that question of Africa. Where does Africa kind of fit into this complex around the diaspora? You mentioned the idea and the tensions in the network, Carol, between should we focus on the diaspora outside of Africa or should we focus on Africa? So I want to just quickly just see where you've, as artists, practitioners, theorists, curators feel about that question of how Africa relates to diaspora?
You have to direct us, Paul.
Okay, David.
I guess that the opening part of my paper really was about essentially that question. And I did try to bring in the Simon Njami, Robert Storr, David A. Betty discussion to try and kind of recenter and refocus that question. Essentially, the politics, as I say, it's a question about what one imagines. And I'm very thankful to much of the reading I've done and the discussion I've been part of, but particularly to the work of Eric Rogoff, in terms of insisting that we can no longer talk about geography, we must talk about the geopolitical. And to remind ourselves that, you know, there's this map or these renditions and the boundaries of nations and all these kinds of things. These are political decisions. And there's been much work around the notion that, as if you like, what one terms Africa has got nothing to do with the Makata map or with the shores or did it. It's about politics. And it's about the way that people want to build affiliations and the way in which people understand what kind of allegiances and alliances that they can make and they need to make. The things that people, the allegiances people need to make in order to survive. And I think that that basic question about survival, which brings in the political, brings us back to what the way in which we begin to imagine Africa and its allegiances. I'm not sure, and you'll notice I didn't use the term diaspora in my paper. I'm a little bit skeptical of the term diaspora, only insofar as that I think terms are also obviously politically generated, and they belong to particular historical moments. And I think the term diaspora was useful at different periods of time. I'm not sure what it can actually do to serve us now. In a sense, particularly within what's housed within the diaspora, of course, is the notion of as a centre. And I'm not quite sure that that's necessarily what I would be thinking that we need to be moving towards. I think we need to be addressing the dispersal across five continents and understanding what the allegiances and connections across those five continents what we need to do to enable those to happen.
Thank you, David. Rhymey, you actually addressed explicitly the idea of alternative to diaspora, and you mentioned terms like traveller, transcultural, transnational. So do you concur with David's idea of moving beyond diaspora? Has diaspora kind of run its course?
Well,
as an artist, as a practitioner.
As a practitioner, I think there are two things. I mean, one thing that I do concur with, I think that I almost always get it wrong. I always think of Benedict Arnold, the chap who sort of the traitor, but Benedict and Anderson, and imagined communities, and the fact that Africa within notion of the diaspora is in fact a spectre, and you know, pardon the pun, but a dark spectre, something so far and kept away, where we imagine. Because the idea of Africa as part of this diaspora is not something that people really want to return to. And the notion, I mean, you go to the kind of the etymology of diaspora and farming and all this business, and all of a sudden realize something's supposed to bear fruit from this dispersal. So that there is a sort of optimistic approach to diaspora, which I think the reality of diaspora as lived is very different. I mean, the optimism that we're supposed to imagine from it is not something that is readily available. I mean, that's why I kept on returning within my paper, the fact that, you know, so at what point do we stop being dispersed? I think that there are benefits, and I ended saying that there are always benefits to these notions. And there always will be. I think as a practitioner, if I'm asked where do I place myself, I just see myself as a British artist. And I say this, advisedly, in that perhaps political boundaries, and again, I agree, we have to discuss geopolitics. There are benefits to me of being a British artist. In the way that, say, being a Nigerian artist, which is another nationality I could very easily claim, would not afford me. I mean, does that make me any more or less one or the other? Again, where do I start or where do I end as a practitioner? But I think Africa is, for me, is important within this because it affects, literally the amount of chili I put on my food. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Carol, do you want to add from your perspective in terms, because you use the word network quite a lot, interconnection.
Yeah. And I think that's, because we used the term African diaspora as part of the network. So again, that was one something that we discussed. And it was the only term we could use to kind of frame what we were trying to do, because particularly within our area of dress studies, look, just the subject is so under researched that we had to have something to kind of frame it for us to then explore it and then move on. But we needed that space to do that initially. So, but as I say, through all the discussions, then there was all these new terms coming in, and network became much more pivotal, much more pivotal term to try and understand how everything was moving backwards, forwards, almost bouncing back. And then for me, I hadn't, previously to 2005, I had never been to Africa. I've told the story before, but I'd always really only looked
physically, but
mentally, but not physically, which has another impact once you've been there. And I'd always kind of looked at North America and the Caribbean, but traveling, we were taken from Lusaka to Livingston by car, and I was so excited because I'd just never seen Zambia before. I was trying to see everything, and just got off the plane, and it was hot, and I fell asleep. And then at the cost of the minibus stop, I woke up, and this guy was walking towards me in a hoodie, Tupac Shakur t-shirt, Timberland boots, low slung jeans. And I went, my God, am I still in Hackney? Where am I? And then I realised I was in this small village in between Lusaka and Livingston. And that thing of bouncing back and these kind of garments representing. And then there was one thing where I just saw lots of women who were just all in skirts. And I remember having trousers on and asking Claire Chono, who's from Zambia, said, is it okay for women to wear trousers? Because everyone's wearing trousers. She went, no, it's just happened, but you're just seeing a lot of women wearing trousers. So it was all these new experiences. But it was just, all of that was kind of taking that on board. I was saying to Elka today about all these different projects that luckily I've been involved in with some way, and the exploring the different ways you can try and understand your place, or I loved what you were saying, David, about either taking things and having that freedom to take whatever you want and losing and letting go of some other things, and that's, we kind of tried to explore that in all those different networks, and so kind of the presentation I gave today would not have been possible without those, and then exploring, and then we were also saying, well, you need time to kind of reflect and think, okay, as David said, where do we go now? Where's the future with that?
Sure, I'm conscious of two things. One is that we've been talking quite a lot at you, and two, that we also need a break. So I think if we, say, have 5 minutes for just some quick preliminary questions from the floor, we have a break, and then reconvene in the concourse, and we reconvene at 12. So if I could just quickly open up to the floor for some one or two quick questions initially, and then we'll obviously continue the discussion throughout the day. There's someone here.
The main thing that's always bugged me about African art is how you quantify and qualify it, because without identifying what you think is African art, how can you refer to an African diaspora with art and things like that? So how do you personally go about it? Because I know you've already made reference to being a British artist as opposed to saying, you know, you're a Nigerian artist, which, you know, for reasons, you know yourself. But how can you refer to a larger scale if you don't really identify? Because I know of artists in Africa who do things, you know, with acrylic or do it with pen and things like that. And when I've showed it to people, they don't see it as African art because it's not, I guess it's not the basic tribal type art form, but I sort of still qualify it as that because the message that comes with it is still essentially, you know, because they're African. So how do you go about doing it yourselves personally?
Okay, so a question about how personally you use the notion of African art in your practice. Can we add another question? I think at the back, someone raised it.
Hey, Well, I'm not sure myself that we should get rid of the term diaspora or not. But I think if we still want to use it, I feel in a way there's a bit of a way of missing. Because sometimes when I read things in exhibitions or catalogues and art theory and so on, the term diaspora seems very abstract and vague. But when you see the works, sometimes the works engage quite directly with things to do with sexuality or gender or class. But it seems to me there's probably a way of missing in between, which doesn't very much theorise or engage with issues of sexuality and gender and class. And I'm sure there's other things. And I think that could be addressed more if we're still going to use the term diaspora.
So what's the question you're...
It's our contribution. Mm. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Contributions are always welcome. Do you like to reply, to respond to the contribution and to the question?
Yeah.
Very briefly, before we have a break.
I mean, maybe I should start because, you, guess I have. I describe myself as a British artist because I'm British. I don't think that what I do is any less or more anything. Now, I'm obsessed with contemporary art practice, which I suppose I should be. You know, this is what I do with my existence. I don't think that an artist, say in Lusaka, is any less obsessed with contemporary art practice. So, you know, seeking some way of defining what an artist does or as African or European, if the source of their imagination is akin to each other, is, you know, it's a desire for someone other than the practitioner. You know, what how and where and why to define any given practice is any one thing. Again, we're back to geopolitics. You know, it's not about what the artist is doing. It is about how that the object, the text, so to speak, is defined after production. And you know, back to the observation, I think one thing that I kind of skipped, and I'd written this rather peculiar, kind of to amuse myself really, series of reports from different departments from the Nation of Diaspora. Board of statistics and board of this, and kind of cartographers and the like. But one thing that kept on returning to me, and one thing I remember discussing the exhibition that I assume everyone's seen, is the relation of violence to diaspora, which is very different to sort of, I guess, a liberal migration, where we define where we want to be. And I think that violence probably responds to the questions you're raising, is that essentially, you know, it's kind of primal, really, our responses to violence. We either fight or we run away. And I suppose that is why a lot of the work that, you know, you say there's a similarity, it's often violence, and it's addressing that.
Thanks, Ryan. That's really useful for me, actually, in terms of my thinking. So I might return to that question at the end. But I'll start with the question. I think your question for me is a question of knowledge. For me, I translated your question as the point, how do we know? And in relation to art, I think questions of knowledge kind of have to be set aside in one respect. Whether you know or don't know, to me, is not the first question when one's thinking about art or one's engagement with art. It, for me, it's about what claim do you make for the work. And that claim and how those claims then get accepted or not accepted, contested, that then is then becomes part of a, if you like, a as Ryan was saying, part of a, for me, it's part of a machinery or part of a process. And that's part of a series of discussions with different people, curators, artists, practitioners, interested people. It becomes a question of, if you like, a circle of people or a collective or community of people who begin to then judge the claim and assess the value of that claim. So how do you know, to me, set aside, and much more thinking about how does one then go, what does one bring to that conversation about what something might mean and what its impact it might have. So that's key to me in that respect. And in relation to diaspora, I don't have much to add, actually. I think the point that you made was really a useful one in terms of thinking about violence. But the only thing is, the reason why, coming back, and thank you for the point that you made, but coming back to my point, why I want to set it aside, is, as I say, I think it belongs to a particular historical moment. And I don't mean it's a moment that was past and will never come back again. It might well come back, and it might well be important elsewhere. But for me now, and in terms of the places that I inhabit, I think there's a different kind of thinking that needs to happen, which lets go of a sense of an origin or a source or even the primal moment, and is actually looking to a moment of futurity. I'm not saying the primal moment isn't important, but it's not the only story. There's another story here, and this other story also needs to be told.
Great, thank you.
I haven't got much to add to David or Amy. I think the only thing in terms of about work is, for me, it's always how I connect with that and what I see in the work, and it doesn't matter whether it's, as Rumi was saying, it's produced here or in Africa, but kind of taking references or connecting with it, that's kind of the main thing for me, and that, you know, putting aside, as David said, the sort of knowledge, but connecting with what's the content, like.
Okay, well, I think we will now take a... Thank you, by the way, to our panel.